Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Understanding and Managing Chemotherapy Side Effects. This is an incredibly important program, and I know that many of you are experiencing side effects from your treatment, and this is the program to be on because we have wonderful speakers to learn more about managing your side effects. We have on the program today a lot of you. We have 1,225 participants on the program today. You come from all over the United States, from all different regions and parts of this country. We also have international participants from Algeria, Bahrain, Brazil, Canada, India, Korea, Malaysia, Pakistan, Poland, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. You are a global audience, and we are very delighted to have you on the call today. Now, this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of all of this collaboration and your interest that we have so many of you on the call today. Today's program, this activity, is supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen and Friends of Cancer Care. And I want to also remind all of you that there is an evaluation form that we ask you to complete at the end of today's program. Please do take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you want us to offer and your suggestions of topics and just ideas that you'd like us to be sure to cover. This is the beginning of a new year, and so we're planning many programs, and your input, your ideas are invaluable to us. Indeed, this topic is one that hands down has been one of the most frequently requested topics for us to offer. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Charles Laprinzi. Dr. Laprinzi is Regis Professor of Breast Cancer Research at the Mayo Clinic, and he is going to address causes of chemotherapy side effects, managing nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and constipation, and practical tips for coping with fatigue and controlling infection. Dr. Laprinzi.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to do this again. Chemotherapy causes a lot of toxicity, and we actually like that when it's toxicity against the cancer, but it causes toxicity against toxicity against normal body tissues, and that's what we're going to talk a bit about today. So I'm going to touch on a number of these different issues. I'll start off with a few words regarding chemotherapy-induced diarrhea. 5-fluorouracil is one drug that's used often for treating cancer, and it is the one that's probably most likely, most commonly associated with diarrhea. There are other things such as irinotecan and methotrexate that can cause trouble that way too. When people get diarrhea from cancer therapy, treatment with medications are oftentimes used. Imodium or loperamide is the one that's most frequently utilized, first line anyway. That can be obtained over the counter at a drugstore. Oftentimes, when the diarrhea can be bad from chemotherapy, we go with much higher doses than what people get over the counter for recommendations there, up to 4 milligrams to start off with and then 2 milligrams every 2 hours for 12 hours or so until control of the diarrhea can be had. Octreotide is another medication or somatostatin analog that sometimes is used for that. On the other end of the spectrum, from diarrhea is constipation, and some of the chemotherapy drugs cause constipation. More often, the other treatment that we give, i.e. narcotic medications or opioids, morphine, codeine, causes a lot of trouble with constipation. And it can be important to try and manage that prospectively before the constipation gets to be too much of a problem. The way I usually manage this is using Senna. There's a drug, Senacot or Senacot S, our brand names. The Senacot S has a little bit of colace or stool softener in it, or just generic Senna. The generic Senna is cheaper than the other two components of that. And again, you use much higher doses than usually are needed for controlling constipation, and sometimes up to 10 tablets of those a day if a person is on a lot of trouble with big doses of narcotics. And a person needs to titrate those two things. Another drug, polyethylene glycol, otherwise known as Miralax or Go Lightly, it's oftentimes used to prepare people for things like colonoscopies. It also could be obtained over the counter, but some people would prefer using that, and again, you may need to get bigger doses than you otherwise you would use for just run-of-the-mill constipation. It's a liquid preparation. Some people will just put it in the fridge and take a swallow or two or three a day to control constipation troubles. Let me move on to cancer fatigue. It's a very, very common problem. There's a lot of different things that can cause it. In addition to the chemotherapy process, the cancer itself and other things such as depression or anemia or thyroid troubles or other things, doctors need to be thinking about those things and evaluating, which usually is done. But oftentimes, the fatigue is a persistent problem despite these efforts to find the etiologies for it. The best thing that's available for fatigue is actually exercise, and some people think they need to get rest, but the best data available suggests that exercise, get an exercise program for a while each day, can help with fatigue through the day. There are medications that have been looked at for this, such as methylphenidate, which is a Ritalin generic name, and similar products to that. Those products with new research are not as good as people thought they were, and some people think they're probably not good enough to use at all. Modafinil or Provigil is another thing that's being investigated. Ginseng, herbal preparation, looks a bit promising in early studies, and that's being investigated further. I'll move on now to nausea and vomiting. And that can come from chemotherapy or people who are getting radiation therapy. There are different types of nausea and vomiting that we think of related to chemotherapy. Acute nausea and vomiting is what we consider within 24 hours of the first dose of chemotherapy. Delayed nausea and vomiting happens from 24 hours on out to 5 days or 96 hours. And another one called anticipatory nausea and vomiting, and that relates to a person who is about ready to have another dose of chemotherapy, and before they get the chemotherapy, they get nausea or vomiting, or they might even drive by the hospital and get nausea and vomiting, or see their chemotherapy nurse in the grocery store and get nausea and vomiting, kind of like the old Pavlov's dog studies where that sight makes you think about what might be coming next. So with the acute and delayed nausea and vomiting, we try to figure out how much nausea and vomiting is associated with the particular chemotherapy agent that a person is scheduled to get. If it is quite a bit, then more medications are given than if it is not very much nausea and vomiting associated with that particular medication, understanding that different people will react differently to the same medications. The drugs that are most commonly utilized now that weren't available 15, 20 years ago are the serotonin 5-HT3 receptor antagonists. That's a mouthful, I know. They're also called the TRON medications, ondansetron, granisetron, duloxetron, or palonosetron. And the brand names, they're mostly known by Zofran, Kytril, Enzamet, and Aloxi. So these are all a class of medications, and they do improve by 20 percentage points or so, decrease the chance that a person will get vomiting from different chemotherapy regimens. Whenever these medications are used, it's commonly useful to also give a corticosteroid medication like dexamethasone, a prednisone-type derivative. This improves by about 10 percentage points the chance that a person won't have vomiting. A newer class of medications is called aprepitant, or a neurokinin 1 receptor antagonist. It doesn't help very much on the nausea and vomiting in the first 24 hours, but is helpful in the nausea and vomiting, the delayed nausea and vomiting that happens a few days later. And this has been available as a 3 pills that people would take, or just recently became available an intravenous formulation, and the company is getting away from the oral preparation, so all of it will be given IV on the first day of chemotherapy. So the best thing that doctors can do with this is, again, understand what's the potential of the different agents to cause nausea and vomiting and have a standard approach to have patients get the appropriate nausea medications at the time prior to receiving the chemotherapy. If people get trouble with nausea and vomiting after chemotherapy, despite getting these medications, and some still do, then other medications such as Compazine or Haloperidol can be used to help decrease that particular problem. And then a few words on infection, the last of the areas that I think I was supposed to cover. And the bottom line suggestion is don't get one. Having said that, the low blood counts that can be associated with chemotherapy can predispose a person to getting infections. There are medications that we give at sometimes a day after the chemotherapy is given. It's a shot given subcutaneously, and it's called a colony stimulating factor. Neulasta or Neupogen is the brand name that's usually used, and it's given to try to stimulate the bone marrow to make blood cells again faster than otherwise would have happened. You have to wait for a day after chemotherapy because the chemotherapy kills off some of those early blood cells to make the more mature ones. And that can, this use of these medications can decrease the chance that the person's going to get a low blood count. It's not indicated in all situations. It does have some side effects, but in some situations they can be helpful. Antibiotics also are utilized once infection comes about and sometimes to try to prevent an infection. The one thing I do talk to patients, they say, you know, do I have to stay indoors and not see anybody? And I recommend the patients getting chemotherapy, and this is for most types of chemotherapy. It might be a bit different if they're high-dose chemotherapy for some blood-type cancers. But to be careful, but not to be a hermit. They need to be able to get up and about, and they shouldn't be around somebody who's clearly sick, but it doesn't mean that they have to stay out of public. So let me stop at this point and let others go on with their parts.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Waprynsi, for a very comprehensive overview covering these topics very well. And there will be questions, I know, for you with the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Douglas Peterson. Dr. Peterson is Professor of Oral Medicine, Chair, Program in Head and Neck Cancer and Oral Oncology, NAE Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Connecticut Health Center. And Dr. Peterson is going to address guidelines for dental care before and during chemotherapy and managing mouth sores and dry mouth. I now turn the program over to Dr. Peterson.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's my privilege, really, to participate today. Certainly, as is the case overall, it's certainly the case when it comes to mouth care and the chemotherapy patient that there be very, very comprehensive communication among the patient, the caregivers, in this case including the dental team, and the rest of the oncology team, even before the chemotherapy begins. It's also important to realize that not all cancer treatments and not all chemotherapy in particular causes mouth problems either during or after that treatment. The effects of chemotherapy on the mouth, when they do occur, typically take place beginning the first few days after the chemotherapy starts until approximately 2 to 3 weeks after the chemotherapy ends. However, given the complexity of some of the types of mouth complications caused by some types of chemotherapy, it really is important to have a comprehensive management of your mouth by your health providers, including a dental checkup and, where appropriate, dental treatment before the chemotherapy begins. So it becomes very important to ask your oncology team before the chemotherapy starts, even weeks before the chemotherapy may start, are there any short-term or long-term effects on the mouth that are anticipated from the chemotherapy I'm about to receive? Or are there any problems in my mouth that may complicate my chemotherapy when it begins in a few days or in a week or two? And depending on the answers to these questions, your dentist and dental hygienist can examine your mouth and prioritize any dental treatment that needs to be accomplished before the chemotherapy begins. Now, since our time is relatively limited today, I'll just make the additional comment that there are excellent resources to patients and families and to the cancer care team to help guide these kinds of decisions and treatment priorities. And cancer care, such as we're sharing today, is one example of really an outstanding resource for additional information. Now, in all patients, as a dentist, I'll advocate excellent health for a patient's teeth and gums and lining tissues of the mouth. That's very important. It's certainly very important in relation to the chemotherapy patient. Having said this, however, not all mouth problems need to be treated before the chemotherapy begins. For example, a very small dental cavity can easily wait until weeks or sometimes months after the cancer treatment ends. However, there are certain kinds of mouth problems, for example, deep cavities or severe gum disease, that may cause problems during the upcoming chemotherapy and need to be treated. And again, this can all be discussed with your cancer team, including the dental team. Just a few words on some of the acute problems, some of the problems that may occur during chemotherapy. And the two that I'd like to briefly address are mouth sores and dry mouth. Now, certain types of chemotherapy can cause a sore mouth. We call it mucositis. And this typically occurs, again, in the first few days after the chemotherapy starts. And then when the chemotherapy ends, the mouth sores or mucositis typically heal in the next 2 to 3 weeks. There are a number of products to help people through the mouth sore experience, something as simple as non-medicated mouth rinses, just keeping the mouth tissues clean, such as water or water and salt, baking soda, for example, to keep the tissues moist and clean. If the sore mouth becomes uncomfortable, then there's some medications that we can put on the sore tissue, or we can prescribe a pill or even give an injection of a stronger pain medication if that will help for a few days. And then, as Dr. Laprinzi mentioned, it's very important to minimize any risk for infection, ideally prevent infection. So the health professional team will be checking constantly for any infections in the mouth, ideally preventing any of those problems. And if they should occur, we've got some very effective treatment options. It's also important to note that none of these approaches that I've talked about, the mouth rinses, the pain medications, the infection management, is designed to prevent the mouth sores from developing. The good news is there is one drug approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration. It's called Palifermin. It's given by injection, and it's utilized in some patients who have certain types of blood cancers and who will be undergoing stem cell transplant and who will be receiving chemotherapy as part of that. But other than Palifermin, the other approaches that we're talking about are designed to help the patient through the mouth sore experience and not actually prevent it. As far as dry mouth is concerned, dry mouth can be a significant problem in some cancer patients, typically in patients getting head and neck radiation. It can cause taste changes, difficulty in chewing, swallowing, and even speaking. However, the good news is that chemotherapy does not typically cause dryness of the mouth directly. However, some other medication that the cancer patient receiving chemotherapy may be also receiving may cause that mouth dryness. And if the mouth dryness occurs, just keeping the tissues moist by sipping water frequently during the day or using sugarless drinks, avoiding caffeine, since caffeine can dry the mouth, avoiding tobacco or alcohol, these can also dry the mouth, and then avoiding spicy or salty foods, which may irritate the mouth. So, in summary, I'd like to emphasize that not all cancer patients develop mouth complications due to their chemotherapy, and it really is key to have that communication with the patient, the caregivers and family, the cancer team, including the dental team. There are excellent resources for patients and families and the cancer team, including cancer care. And then finally, this kind of partnership, this collaboration, can lead to important and very positive outcomes in relation to chemotherapy. Carolyn, I'll end there and turn the program back to you and my other colleagues.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Peterson. Just a wonderful presentation and just really covering all the issues around mouth care, and I know there'll be questions for you about this and dental care. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Julie Silver. Dr. Silver is Assistant Professor, Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Silver is going to address really how to describe neuropathy to your healthcare team and tips to cope with neuropathy and pain. Dr. Silver?
Hi, thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be talking to all of you. One of the questions that I get very frequently is, how can I control the pain that I'm having from neuropathy? Most people actually know what neuropathy is. They know the numb feeling, the tingling, the pain that comes with it. Usually in cancer survivors, it has to do with chemotherapy, and they call that chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. It may be also caused by things like diabetes, and perhaps if you have diabetes and have a little bit of underlying neuropathy, the chemotherapy can actually make that much worse. when you're in treatment and getting chemotherapy, a lot of times your oncologist may decrease the dose of the medication or increase the time between the different dosing. So you may get your chemotherapy instead of every other week. You might get it every third week or every fourth week. Or sometimes it's stopped altogether. Other times it's not discontinued and you simply live with the symptoms. The good news is that it usually doesn't get worse when you're done with chemotherapy. In fact, usually it gets better, and it may improve for up to 1 to 2 years. And that brings me to this really important point about the difference between an impairment and a disability. So when people have chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, the nerves in the fingers and in the feet, they can actually improve and help to heal themselves up to 1 to 2 years. When they stop healing, that's the impairment. That is what you see on physical examination, the actual injury to the nerves. Disability is what people can't do because of the impairment. So even people who have neuropathy for 5 years or 10 years, while you might not be able to improve the impairment, you can improve the disability, and that's the good news, is that everyone on this call with chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy potentially can have improved functional status and less disability due to the problem. And here's how. So treatment options for this problem, you can definitely talk to your doctor about medications. Some of the medications are topical medications, like they might be a cream, a lidocaine cream, or sometimes compounding creams like gabapentin or Neurontin. You can also take these medications orally, not the lidocaine so much, but the gabapentin or the Neurontin, or pregabalin and Lyrica. These are medications that specifically help with nerve pain. There are other medications as well that you can take orally that might help, such as nortriptyline, amitriptyline. Sometimes anti-inflammatories can help with pain. Sometimes acetaminophen or Tylenol can help with pain. One of the main things to really know about your medication regimen is, number one, have you tried different classes of medications? If you have just tried anti-inflammatory medications and you found that they don't work very well, talk to your doctor about trying another class of medications. Maybe the anti-seizure class that really helps with nerve pain would be another class, and that would be the Neurontin or the gabapentin. Another thing to be thinking about and talking to your doctor about is the dose and whether you're on a high enough dose. A third thing is whether the medication is PRN or as needed, or if it's a regular medication. If you're taking a medication regularly, or you should be taking it regularly, but you're actually taking it only as needed, it might not be doing what it's supposed to be doing. And finally, in terms of medications, especially the as-needed or the PRN medications, I try to tell my patients, don't let the pain get ahead of you. Try to take your medication in the morning before you have too much pain. If you take, for example, Tylenol, and you have a terrible, terrible headache, it's really hard for the Tylenol to work. If you take it right in the beginning of your headache, it works much better. The same is true for all pain that you have and all medications that work on pain. So those are the medications, but there's also non-drug treatments. There are a lot of non-pharmacologic treatments, including relaxation therapy, meditation, acupuncture, transcutaneous nerve stimulation, or that's sometimes called TENS for short. And physical and occupational therapy can also be helpful. There was a woman that was just presented at a medical conference who ran the Boston Marathon, and she was having problems with her balance. And she had taken a terrible fall during her training before the Boston Marathon and actually went to a physical therapist and really worked on balance and gait, and that helped her with her running and complete the marathon. So balance and gait and focusing on that can be really helpful. Pay extra attention to your feet, especially if that's the area where you have your neuropathy, at least once a week. Often is better. Use a handheld mirror to check your feet for sores or open wounds. Make sure that you have comfortable shoes. Make sure that they're deep enough. We call shoes, sometimes they're labeled extra wide or extra depth, and those are better for people with neuropathy to have a little bit of room in the shoes. Also, sometimes you can try rock or bottom soles. People often have questions about these rocker bottom soles. You may have seen these on the internet. They have some shoes that are sneakers that have sort of a, if you can imagine, a rocking horse. The bottom of the rocking horse has that smooth, rounded, sort of almost a half circle edge. That's what you can do to a shoe to sort of bring your leg and your body over it easily without putting a lot of pressure on your foot. Sometimes they're rockered too much, though, and it sort of pushes you forward too much, and that can be dangerous. So just be careful about that. And finally, there's a lot of different types of equipment that you can use, like a smartphone instead of having to type, or text or whatever is a great one, voice-activated software, handheld tools that can help with wide grips, electric appliances instead of handheld can openers, and so on. Bottom line, focus on function, focus on improving your level of disability and improving your pain. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Silver. Excellent presentation and really lots of good information to use to cope with some of these discomforts that you've mentioned. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Mario LaCouture, and Dr. LaCouture is Associate Attending Physician, Department of Dermatology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And he is really going to address the recommendations to handle rash, dry skin, and hair loss, and protecting the skin from the sun and wind. Dr. LaCouture?
Thank you, Carolyn, and I would like to thank all of you listening to us today. And as I will be speaking about the skin, it is important to remember that in a study of 700 people living with cancer, 45% of people had skin findings or skin conditions, including dry skin, itching, and its skin infections even prior to the anti-cancer treatments. Also, a survey of 379 cancer survivors showed that over a third experienced skin irritation and dry skin during their oncological treatment, and of these, half indicated that this side effect had a negative impact on their lives. Therefore, it is of utmost importance to correctly maintain your skin during your treatment so that you can better tolerate the treatments and also be more comfortable. Many of the drugs used by your oncologist are very effective in your treatment, but will also affect an innocent bystander, which also happens to be the largest organ in your body, your skin. The drugs used by your oncologist will affect your skin because this organ is constantly self-renewing itself. Every 28 days, you will have a completely new layer of skin. Therefore, it is prone to the anti-growth effects of most anti-cancer treatments. Rashes are very common with drugs that are commonly used, such as gemcitabine, doxorubicin or adriamycin, taxanes, and fluorouracil. The most important part of rashes to these drugs, however, is that they are usually treatable so that people living with cancer can continue with their therapy. In addition to these drugs, a type of treatment that has emerged over the past decade, known as the targeted therapies, also causes significant problems in the skin, hair, and nails. Targeted treatments commonly cause four side effects that affect the skin: an acne-like rash, nail inflammation, dry skin, and itching and hair changes. The most commonly used drugs are called erlotinib or Tarceva, cetuximab or Erbitux, panitumumab or Vectibix, and lapatinib or Tycurb. The symptoms of rash to these drugs can range from mild discomfort with itching to a painful sensation in bumps in the skin. In most people, however, the rash is mild to moderate and will not affect their daily lives. However, it may look like acne appearing on the face, scalp, and upper chest, but it is important to remember that this is really not acne and will not improve with most anti-acne medicines. Importantly, it will also appear within the first month. Inflammation of the fingers or toes is also common and may make it hard to pick up small things such as a pen or fork, and some people will have trouble buttoning buttons or putting on shoes. So what should people living with cancer and their caregivers do when facing one of these problems? The first and most important thing is to tell your oncologist or your oncology nurse as soon as you begin having any of these symptoms, even if they appear before the next appointment. You can call your oncologist or the nurse and tell them about it. Your doctor may prescribe topical or oral medicines, which are usually effective, so start using them immediately. Importantly, do not stop taking your medicines prescribed by your oncologist unless they tell you to do so. Use for dry skin, use ointments or creams and avoid lotions as they contain alcohol. Your doctor may prescribe creams containing corticosteroids to red inflamed areas. For inflammation around the fingers or toenails, you may use soft shoes and avoid trauma to these areas. Topical antibiotics or oral antibiotics may be necessary. Some drugs may cause increased hair growth in the face, which is a particular problem for women. Electric razors are preferred over chemical depilatories or waxing. Makeup is safe to use in the great majority of cases, but avoid using those with many ingredients and stop using them if they result in redness and itching. So if you are in doubt of what to use, apply a small amount behind your ear, leave it on for several hours, and see if you develop any itching or irritation. In terms of dry skin, it is important to remember that this will be worse in the winter months, especially in areas that have a very severe winter with snow. So some suggestions to relieve dry skin include keeping the air in your home moist by lowering the heat. Ask your doctor or nurse about other things that can help to humidify the air. In some cases, they may allow you to have a humidifier. Take short baths or showers with warm or cool water every other day. If you must shower daily, take a brief shower and do not soak in a tub for a long time. Some soaps may be harsh on your skin. Use a gentle soap with moisturizers and no fragrances or perfumes. Apply a moisturizer right after the shower or bath within 15 minutes while your skin is still damp. Avoid friction on your skin. Do not rub it dry. Pat it with a towel. Reapply your moisturizer at bedtime as well. Protect the exposed skin from winter weather such as the wind or the sun. Wear hats and gloves when you're outdoors. And avoid direct contact with fabrics such as wool or angora. Ideally, use 100% cotton clothes, and then you can use layers if it is too cold. Treat your dry skin on your hands and feet with a very occlusive moisturizer. Ideally, use moisturizers that come in a tub. The thicker the moisturizer, the better. And if you can, you can use cotton gloves at night to protect your hands, and so the moisturizer is absorbed better. And finally, in terms of sunscreens, it is important to remember that you must use a sunscreen that has a sun protection factor or SPF of at least 30. You must apply it every 2 hours when going outside and 2 hours prior to leaving your home. Use at least an ounce or 30 grams to apply for the entire body, so like a half of a small glass. Spread a thin layer on the skin and wait for it to absorb, and then you may want to apply another thin layer. So I hope that these recommendations are helpful during treatment and may enable you to better cope with treatments and some of the most commonly seen dermatologic side effects. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. LaCouture. That's an excellent presentation. Lots of important help for everyone in terms of the dermatologic issues. And I know there'll be questions for you. And I want to remind everyone that we really have the entire multidisciplinary team represented here. So we definitely, I know, will have lots of questions for each of them. Our next speaker is Maria Petzl. Maria is a senior clinical dietitian at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Maria is really going to address nutrition concerns and tips to prevent dehydration. Maria?
Thank you very much, Carolyn. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk today. We've just listened to some great information from our physicians, and I have to say, absolutely, their suggestions are number one. Nutrition is a great complement to these medical therapies, but nutrition alone cannot manage side effects. Nutrition is something that you can control and something that allows you to play a role in your treatment and recovery. So I'm going to talk about some nutrition tips for those side effects real quickly. With regards to nausea and vomiting, some things that patients or family members can do are to eliminate offending odors from the house or at mealtime. So using cold or room temperature foods. If you are cooking foods, opening a window in the kitchen or having your loved one step out of the house to help limit those offending odors. Avoiding foods that are overly sweet, greasy, fried, or highly spiced, as these can really sit in the stomach for a while and cause more discomfort. For dry mouth, It can be helpful to increase the fluid content of foods by adding gravies, broths, or sauces. Using well-cooked foods, tender meats, and cutting these foods into small pieces to reduce the amount of chewing that is required. For mouth sores, avoiding foods that can irritate the mouth, citrus fruits, fruit juices that are made from citrus fruits, acidic foods, things that are tomato-based, or foods that are pickled using vinegar. Spicy and salty foods can cause discomfort, as well as rough, coarse, or dry foods. Use a straw to drink liquids and bypass mouth sores. Eat foods that are cold or at room temperature because hot and warm foods can irritate a tender mouth. And also you can use ice chips or flavored ice pops to numb the mouth. Regarding bowel management, there can be multiple causes of diarrhea, but independent of the cause of the diarrhea, some things that you can do are to decrease foods that are high in insoluble fiber. This is an undigestible fiber that draws more fluid into the gut. So these are things like your bran cereals, raw vegetables, raw greens, fruits with thick skins. Also, even in people that are not lactose intolerant, if you're having large amounts of diarrhea, lactose-containing foods can contribute to that. So really reducing lactose-containing foods. Things to eat more of are foods that are high in soluble fiber. Soluble fiber works by creating more of a gel and binding the stool together. We get soluble fiber from oats, from apple without the peel or applesauce, from citrus without membrane, also from bananas, and the greener the better. It's really, really important to stay hydrated. I'm going to touch on hydration a little in just a moment. On the opposite side of things, dealing with constipation. Again, it's really important to stay hydrated, and not just with regular fluids, but you can use more hot fluids if you don't have mouth sores, because hot fluids can help stimulate the gut to move. It's also good to include all high-fiber foods, so high-fiber foods from soluble and insoluble sources. So the bran cereals are helpful in these circumstances. The salads, fruits and vegetables can be very helpful to help minimize constipation. With regards to hydration, it's very, very important to stay hydrated. Dehydration can cause symptoms such as constipation or nausea to be worse. Most patients require between 6 and 12 cups per day of non-alcoholic, non-caffeinated fluid, and one cup is 8 ounces. So a lot of people will come to me and say, I just can't drink that much. I have to go to the bathroom all the time. So the first thing I recommend is that you start early in the day. If someone drinks 8 ounces per hour starting at 8 o'clock in the morning and they need to have 8 cups of fluid in the day, by 4 p.m. they've met their fluid requirement. So from 4 p.m. on, you can just sip as needed, and that way that will eliminate some of the waking up in the middle of the night to use the restroom. Another tip is to fill a pitcher or fill the appropriate number of water bottles the night before and put those in the refrigerator, and then you know by the end of the next day you need to have all of those consumed. And then finally, if you're having diarrhea or if you are having some vomiting, it's really important to replace electrolytes that are lost in these fluids. Great sources of electrolytes from fluid are going to be sports drinks. Ideally, your regular sports drinks like Gatorade or Powerade should be consumed half water and half sports drink, or you can use the newer G2 product, which has all the electrolytes but less sugar, and so this is a little better tolerated. Also, Pedialyte. This is a children's electrolyte drink, but this works very well, and adults can use this as well. So it's very important to stay hydrated and replace those electrolytes. Now, this has been a very limited time to go over just a few nutrition tips for these side effects, but I do encourage you to follow up with Cancer Care for more information and for resources. Also, ask to speak with an oncology dietitian at your cancer center. And there's a great booklet from cancer.gov or from the National Cancer Institute called Eating Hints. This is something that's available for free, and this can give more information and more in-depth information regarding side effect management. I'm going to turn it back over to Carolyn. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. These are wonderful tips. And now we do have time for questions. I want to thank all of our speakers, and we now have time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board and to answer all these questions. And I'm going to ask Mary to explain to all of you how to queue up and ask questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, please call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. Our staff are here to answer your questions. So let's see how many we can take right now. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Jackie G.
My husband is getting gemcitabine and carboplatin IV weekly and nebulizer albuterol treatments four times a day. He's lost his sense of taste and he has no appetite. Is there any way we can stimulate his taste buds and get him to eat more?
Excellent question. Ashley Maria, would you like to address that in a general way in terms of stimulating appetite?
Certainly. With regards to stimulating appetite, one of the first strategies that we work towards is really planning meals and eating on a schedule rather than depending on the body to trigger with hunger. So that can be very helpful. You can supplement meals and snacks with supplement drinks. That may be easier, especially if he's doing some nebulizer treatments. Having something liquid can help replace a meal or replace a snack and give him some good calories and protein. With one of the specific chemotherapy drugs is a platinum-based drug that she mentioned, and this can cause a metallic taste. And unfortunately, we can't really eliminate that metallic taste, but I would definitely recommend using plastic utensils and servingware so that he's not introducing any more metal into his mouth, and that can help reduce some of those metallic tastes. And then finally, if he doesn't have mouth sores, using tart flavors, so lemons, vinegar, pickles, are a way to enhance some flavors of foods.
Excellent. Thank you very much, and I hope that's helpful, Jackie. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Mary W.
Yes, thank you for the presentation. This is addressed to the dentist. What would you think about extraction of teeth or implants after 2 years on pimidronate, bisphosphonate IV?
Yes, that raises a very, very interesting question. This is Dr. Peterson. There is literature that suggests that a relatively small percentage of patients who've been on intravenous bisphosphonate, such as pimidronate, after about a year and a half, in some studies it's closer to 2 to 3 years after the beginning of pimidronate, may be at risk for developing osteonecrosis of the jaw. But I do want to stress, Mary, that it's a very small percentage, just 1, 2, 3, up to 10% of patients may develop some manifestation of this bone lesion. So this is something to be discussed with the patient's cancer team, the patient's dental team. There'll be a very careful oral examination and a very thorough discussion of the benefits of an extraction or an implant in relation to the possible risk of osteonecrosis of the jaw. So it really becomes this communication of the patient, the family, with the healthcare team that can help come up with the very best decision.
Thank you. Excellent question. Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Carol L.
Yes, my question is, what is the largest recommended dose of gabapentin for neuropathy?
So gabapentin is a drug that can be utilized in doses up to 3,000 or 3,600 milligrams per day, and sometimes is used for treating pain from nerve-type troubles, including diabetic neuropathy and other nerve troubles. Having said that, and it is available, it's used frequently for treatment of chemotherapy neuropathy. The truth is, though, that the best study that's been done looking at it, a placebo-controlled trial, and I happen to have been involved with it, was unable to actually show that it helped for chemotherapy-induced neuropathy. And maybe that's a fluke in there, but those are where things are. But up to 3,000 or 3,600 milligrams per day has been used with this drug.
Okay, thank you very much. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Patricia B.
Hi. Thank you so much for the presentation. It was extremely informative. About 20 years ago, I had actinomycin D, and I had terrible mouth sores. And at that time, what was recommended to me for mouth sores was, if I'm not mistaken, Maalox, or one of those chalky liquids that I could, you know, squish around and spit out. Dr. Peterson, you didn't mention that. I wonder, do they not do that anymore, or is that something that is still recommended, or that was my question.
Well, thank you for your question. Dr. Peterson?
Yes. Patricia, you raise a very important issue, and that's, as I briefly mentioned, that there's only one currently approved drug in the United States to prevent mouth sores caused by chemotherapy, and it's in relation to patients with some kinds of blood cancers and, very importantly, receiving chemotherapy followed by a stem cell transplant. The approaches outside of that include products such as you mentioned, such as these mouth coating agents. Sometimes we'll combine those thick mouth coating agents with a topical local anesthetic solution, a low concentration of that. And sometimes we'll even add in something that has a soothing effect because of an antihistaminic effect as well. So sometimes we'll combine these mouth coating agents with a topical anesthetic and or something that just soothes the mouth. Now, these are good approaches, and we still use them currently. What we're hoping, though, and drugs are in development, so we're very excited about this, is to come up with new ways, in addition to these traditional ways, to actually prevent the mouth sores from occurring.
Excellent. And in terms of, so if someone is actually in that phase of having a mouth sore, and they don't qualify for the other names for these, how would they go about asking their doctor, or what would they ask for?
Yeah, the best approach would be to discuss the possibility of using something to take several times a day by mouth, and then rinse the mouth for about a minute, and then spit the product out. We typically don't have patients swallow these. They go by a number of different names depending on the hospital in which the patient's being treated. But if you simply say, is there some coating agent that I can use several times a day to help control any discomfort that I may have from the mouth sores, the cancer team should be well equipped to help design that approach.
Thank you. This is fantastic. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Roberta C.
Yeah, just curious, the role now of glutamine in preventing peripheral neuropathy, maybe also in terms of mucositis. I know it's been controversial.
I'm going to ask, thank you for that question. I'm going to ask Dr. Laprenzi if he would address the glutamine, and Dr. Peterson if he would address the mucositis. Okay.
So I will start with this. And glutamine's been around for a long time. We actually did conduct a trial looking at it to try to prevent mucositis some time ago, and unfortunately it did not work. There are other reports that suggested that it did, but our group was not able to clarify that it did work. With regards to neuropathy, there are a couple of small reports suggesting that it might be helpful for some patients getting high doses of paclitaxel chemotherapy. But it's not proven to be helpful in this situation. It's on the list of things that would be nice to study a bit more. It's not high up on the list of things that would be nice to be studied a bit more. I guess there are other things that sound more interesting than that to study or more helpful there, but that's where it is. Dr. Peterson, you have more to add on the mucositis issue?
Well, just simply to follow your lead, Dr. Laprenzi, relative to the mucositis, there is real need for further research to try and find additional approaches, potentially including glutamine, that could reduce or even prevent the mucositis. Our group was involved in some of this research over the years and combined this glutamine with a novel approach to deliver the L-glutamine to the mouth tissues specifically. And this has been published, and it's been under review by the Food and Drug Administration. It's not approved yet. We hope someday it would be once further research is conducted, but it's still in a what we call a clinical trial phase. And so as Dr. Laprinzi suggests, there's some question about whether glutamine would be helpful to prevent mucositis. It appears that more research is needed.
I have to say, these are wonderful questions from this audience. This is terrific. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Arthur B.
Yes, thank you for an excellent presentation. This may be a little bit out of the ballpark, but I am on dexamethasone and Revlimid for light chain myeloma, and I need to have cataract surgery in both eyes. Is that okay to do, and is there a best time to do it?
So that's a great question, Arthur. And Dr. Laprinzi, can you address that in a general way and then help him to figure out a plan?
Yeah, very general way. And that is, one, the dexamethasone can increase the risk of causing cataracts, so that might be causative. It's given to try to help the multiple myeloma process for there. So that's kind of one of those things that comes about there. And talking with the so if I had a patient in such a situation, talking with the ophthalmologist and then trying to coordinate with your hematologist or oncologist giving you the Revlimid as to whether to hold off on the Revlimid for a time around the time of surgery. So I would defer that question to an ophthalmologist.
And actually, this raises a really wonderful point. We don't have an ophthalmologist on this call, but we are the concept of this multidisciplinary team where we have all these different specialists, because all of you have very unique and specific issues. And so the idea is that like the ophthalmologist working with your oncologist, or we have with a dentist working with a medical oncologist. But those are very important things we want you to take away from here, so that everyone's working together. So thank you. Great question, Arthur. Thank you. And we hope you'll talk with your ophthalmologist and your medical oncologist and work out a plan for you that will really help with your quality of life. That's very important. Thank you. Our next question.
Our next question comes from Colleen R.
I'd like to thank all the speakers today for presenting the way they did. This is very informative, and thank you for taking time out of your schedules. I have a two-part question. My mother has just completed just over half of her chemotherapy, and she's also type 2 diabetic. She is suffering greatly from neuropathy right now, and it's a twofold question. I'd like to know, is there a source available that lists all of the creams and oral medications? I had trouble copying them down earlier. And are there exercises available that would assist to reduce the effects of neuropathy, or maybe there are specific ones that work best with type 2 diabetics? Thank you.
Excellent question. Dr. Silva, do you want to start with that one? And
sure.
I know Dr. Laprinzi may want to, yes.
Sure. So in terms of pain treatment and medications, one thing to really know about pain treatment is that it often is multimodal, meaning that you're going to try more than one thing at a time. A lot of times in practice, what you see in studies don't necessarily bear out what you see in practice. So, for example, there may not be a study that shows the use of using acetaminophen together with an anti-inflammatory and then using gabapentin at bedtime. But maybe for a particular patient, that's the best regimen. So in practice, you'll sort of mix and match things a lot to try to figure out what's going to help that patient. You may not necessarily use three medications, and I'm not suggesting that you do, but you'll try different things depending on that patient's presentation. So that's really important in pain management, to be thinking about what have they tried in the past and have the things that have been done in the past been done together with other interventions that will really give it the maximal effect for that patient. In terms of the list of medications, I don't know of any specific list. I mean, there certainly are lists in the medical literature and things, and Cancer Care, you have published in the past other teleconferences and booklets on this, so that Carolyn certainly has more information, and Cancer Care has more information, as well as information from this conference itself as well. In terms of exercise probably won't improve the actual injury to the nerves, but it certainly can help with the functional piece of it, like balance and gait, and just being more mobile and being more active often helps people with pain because they're thinking about other things rather than thinking about their pain. So the more sedentary they are, oftentimes the more pain they have.
Excellent. Thank you. And we actually do have publications at Cancer Care on neuropathy, so those would be good for you to access. Perhaps you and I could talk after the call so we can be sure you get those materials. And Dr. Laprinzi, did you want to add anything in terms of...
I will add something. This has been an interest of our group in looking at diabetic or chemotherapy-induced neuropathy, and part of the reason that there's not a good great list is that it's kind of like mucositis that Dr. Peterson meant, that there's the mention that he mentioned one drug that's approved there, but there aren't any drugs approved for treatment of chemotherapy-induced neuropathy. There are leads. It's kind of a hit and miss, and there might be some things that work for some people that don't for others, i.e., when we did our placebo-controlled trial, gabapentin was no better than placebo. And yet in practice, it seems like it helps people, and maybe it helps some people and hurts other people, so on average there was no difference, but it might be that that helps there. Gabapentin might be helpful for the diabetic neuropathy part of things. The other drugs that would be on the list of things where there's some information, although no proof yet, that might work are things like nortriptyline that was mentioned by Dr. Silver before, venlafaxine, which is Effexor, and duloxetine, which is Cymbalta. There is suggestive evidence that those might be helpful, but for, you know, placebo-controlled trials are in development or process for looking at those. There's a topical cream with amitriptyline, ketamine, and baclofen, that a preliminary suggestion was that it helps some, and ongoing studies are trying to replicate that. But again, a dearth or a lack of agents that that we've really shown that are helpful in this really prominent problem, and a lot of work ongoing to try to get results, get beneficial things for it.
So there's clearly a lot more work that needs to be done. There's more research going on. We would encourage you actually to bring your questions again to your healthcare team to see if they can be of help to you as well. I actually want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been extraordinary. And I want to thank all of our participants who asked questions because they really have enhanced the call. And I also just want to thank all of you who've been listening. I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour education program. However, although the education program will be ending shortly, your services that you can access from Cancer Care, those are continuous, and you can contact us at any time for help. And I want to just review with you the services you can get from Cancer Care. They're all free. We do provide practical and financial assistance. We have a copay foundation. We also provide counseling services, which is a fancy word for someone to talk to, so someone who you can talk with and actually address some of your concerns with. We also offer support groups on the telephone. A lot of people like telephone support groups or online. That would be depending on the technology you prefer. We have lots of publications and fact sheets and, of course, many upcoming Connect workshops, telephone workshops that you can participate in. So there's a lot for you to choose from, and as we conclude, I don't want anyone to think that you are alone in coping with cancer. Please feel part of a community of support. We are here for you and really just a telephone call away. And, again, that number is 1-800-813-HOPE. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.